So we have three speakers. Each speaker will go for about 20 minutes, and then there will be a Q&A afterwards. So you will definitely get a chance to ask Gail some great questions. I have some as well.
And so the California Progressive Alliance is trying to connect all these local progressive alliances and the Our Revolution groups and other progressive groups. And that's kind of what we're doing. So today, though, I want to talk about the local work that we've done and that we continue to do in Richmond. We think it's a good model, and I know other many other cities in California and some in other places. I know I just talked to Johanna, who said they're doing a variation of a Progressive Alliance in Portland. So I know there's good work happening, probably. I know there's good work happening in Boston, whether it's a local Progressive Alliance or not, I don't know. But in any case, what we're going to do is have this PowerPoint, and I'll share with you some of the work we've done, how we did it, and how we continue to work. So, first of all, the Richmond Progressive Alliance is the name of the organization. We are a local community defining our own destiny. Richmond is a beautifully diverse community, and we have 110,000 people, 40% Latino, 27% African American, 17% white, and 13% Asian. We're also the home to a 117-year-old Chevron oil refinery. It's the largest refinery in California. It's also the single largest greenhouse gas polluter. And it impacts our community big time, as you can imagine, with toxic air contaminants and air pollutants daily. It also hasn't paid its fair share of taxes and doesn't hire locally. So we had a lot of reasons to fight back against Chevron. So the bottom line of Chevron is that it's responsible, and this is the refinery in Richmond, for 10% of Chevron's worldwide sales and profits, $25 billion in sales per year. That's $2.5 billion in profits per year. So that's what they get out of polluting our community. And 94% of their $40 billion a year capital budget goes, this is Chevron at large, goes to more exploration and development of oil and gas, and only 3% goes to making their refineries and chemical plants safe with low emissions. That, of course, presents a great risk to workers and community. We had a huge fire at the Richmond refinery, the Chevron Richmond refinery. In 2012, 15,000 people went to local hospitals for respiratory treatment. You could see it. We're across the bay, by the way, Richmond, from San Francisco. So you could see the plume all the way in San Francisco. We sued Chevron, got not enough, but got some money for that, $5 million, I think. So before the Richmond Progressive Alliance was formed in 2003, Richmond was known with a history of corruption and crime. It was known for the three C's. Crime was something, you grow up in a city with this in the shadow of a refinery, and of course people of color are largely around the refinery, and when the focus is on what Chevron wants the city to do and not on what's best for our residents, people reach states of desperation. We had high crime, low income. So it was known for crime, corruption, and Chevron. It was the three C's that they used to say. Richmond, oh yeah, that's crime, corruption, and Chevron. But we changed that. All the elected officials before the RPA were Chevron funded in their campaigns. There were a couple who weren't, but they still were dominated by Chevron. This is a little cartoon, walking the candidates walking to the tomb of Chevron. Okay, so in 2003, that's when the RPA emerged. So people had built smaller organizations. It's not that organizations didn't exist and fight back on Chevron to the best that they can, but they didn't have decision makers sitting on the city council. So it was limited what they could do. So we decided to come together, and many of us activists working in various capacities, against war, helping the homeless, against police brutality, and against Chevron. And we formed an alliance that was going to run candidates who take no corporate money and to build a local movement around the issues of our city. So that's what we did. And what happened was that for the really the first time in decades, people organized at a major level and stood up to the oil giant. So in recent years, and I'm talking about 10 plus years, we really did release Chevron's iron grip. And we were able to do this by forming a grassroots movement. We disregarded party affiliation. You know, some were green, some were progressive Democrats, some were peace and freedom members, some were independents. And then we also made sure we ran candidates that could not be bought. As an example, in 2014, Chevron outspent us 20-1, and all our candidates won, while all of Chevron's funded candidates lost. So we got a lot of national attention for that. So here is the history of candidate victories that we have. There's actually, I'll mention the 2018 election later. In 2004, I was elected to city council. I was the first RPA member to sit on the city council. And I was a lone member, very lonely and hard, not only for those first 2 years, but also for the next 2 years, when I was for the next part of my mayoral term. So for 2 years, I was mayor, but also the only RPA council member of the council on the city council. So in 2006, I ran and won my campaign for mayor. In 2008, Jeff Ritterman ran for city council. These are all our wins. 2010, I ran my campaign and won it, re-elected as mayor. 2010, we also elected Jovanka Beckles for city council. And 2014, that was our major win because we, Chevron spent lots of money to try and defeat us, $3 million, but we all won. And this was my running for council after I turned out as mayor, and Jovanka Beckles and Eduardo Martinez running for city council. We called ourselves Team Richmond. Then in 2016, Melvin Willis and Ben Choi won their council races. And at that point, after the 2016 election, RPA had a supermajority of the city council, 5 out of 7. In about a decade, we were able to do this by, you know, reaching out to people. And in each of the campaigns, Chevron heavily funded the opposition. So what were some of the things that we were able to do? Well, we were able to get some fair taxation from Chevron. Thanks to community mobilization, we brought Chevron to the negotiating table, and we forced $114 million in additional taxes that Chevron had to give to the city over a period of years. We also reduced crime. Homicides dropped really dramatically, a 75% reduction in homicides over the 8 years that I was mayor, and that's because we had a community mobilization that pushed, and I pushed for policies that addressed the root causes of crime rather than more police on the streets. So we had all kinds of an Office of Public Safety that hired people who had been in prison that you know, were turning their lives around and reaching out and quelled the violence on our streets before it began. We had jobs that we offered and you know, substance abuse programs, all kinds of things. So that was a big success to reduce crimes so dramatically. And you can see some of our movement building people, you know, and that's Jovanka Beckles. That's our police chief who got in a lot of trouble from the rank and file, and he didn't care, which was great. He's a very reform-minded person. During a protest, Jovanka and myself, Jovanka was vice mayor, I was mayor, and we stood with a protest for Black Lives Matter. We raised the minimum wage. This is one of our newest and youngest council members, Melvin Willis, actually ran for mayor after being on council for 2 years. He didn't make it, but he got something like 46% of the vote. So he's going to run again, I believe, in 2022 and make it that time. So we raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour as of January 1st, 2019. We passed the first new rent control law in California in 30 years in 2016. some of our community members who worked on that. We had a green job training program where we put our young people to work in solar installation. We became number one in the Bay Area. Here's Richmond, a low-income, working-class community that became number one in the Bay Area for solar installed per capita because of our emphasis on renewables and training our young people and, you know, whoever was interested in being trained. So how did we accomplish all this? So this is where I want to share some information. I think a lot of this you all know. But the way we did this, as I mentioned, was to form that movement called the Richmond Progressive Alliance and to also run corporate-free candidates. We call them corporate-free, doesn't that mean it's no corporate money? But first of all know that the role of elections in a capitalist society, you know, is problematic. Money rules elections in our pseudo-democracy. Most elected officials end up doing what their corporate funders want, playing the reform game and keeping alive a system, capitalism, which is feeding and rewarding greed, inequality, oppression, planetary destruction, and permanent war. So we know there are problems with elections, and the people who get elected too often are not doing what we as socialists want them to do and address the systemic wrongs and build a movement, which is, you know, essential. However, elections are important. They're key opportunities to organize and develop power for working families and to take power away from the 1% oligarchs that rule. Now, participating in elections must be about developing that working people power. It's not just, oh, let's get this one person elected. It's got to be that people feel a role in their civic involvement in their city, wherever, and feel an empowerment happening because we're doing it together and pressuring those that are holding us back, putting a lot of pressure on them. And the role of any corporate-free candidate must be not only to not take corporate money, but to accumulate more power for working people. They must know that. We make that clear. And when you get elected, if you get elected, you have to keep accumulating that power and keep organizing. So how do we use elections to our advantage? Well, as I mentioned, developing an independent political movement. I think it's really, really important. It has to be independent. That means you allow people from whatever their party registration is to join. And we had Progressive Democrats, Green, Socialists, Peace and Freedom, Independence. You know, it's the issues of your city and your values that should define your independent movement. And the Democratic Party never endorsed any of us candidates. I was a Green Party member during all my local campaigns. I switched to NPP, no party preference, during my actually, when Bernie Sanders first ran, I switched, so that was 2016, I guess. But we had Progressive Democrats, the majority of the other, if not all, I think all the other candidates that won were Progressive Democrats, but the local Democratic Party never endorsed them either. They knew our politics, and we know Democratic Party is corporate controlled and its leadership, even though there's good Progressive Democrats. So we stay apart from that. If people want to try and get a Democratic Party endorsement, fine, but we don't count on it. Our approach to politics, this is the RPA campaign strategy. It's pretty simple. Accept no corporate contributions, 100% volunteer effort. Look for community leaders to be our candidates. Develop our platform based on struggles of our community allies and our activists throughout the community. We have a platform, and it's fluid. We change it periodically as new issues arise. And we run as a slate whenever possible, and we often run more than one. There's more than one seat open every election. It's more economical that way. For example, if you're going to put out a mailer and you have three candidates running, put out campaign signs, each candidate committee only has to pay for a third of the mailer, so that's economic. But we also have individual campaign literature. We want our individual candidates to showcase, you know, their priorities, which are our priorities, but sometimes one candidate prioritizes one thing, another, another, and we want that all to go out. We also have individual campaign teams, but then we have a campaign coordinating committee that coordinates our PA candidates together. And we have issue-oriented campaign literature. We might put out a mailer about a ballot measure or just, you know, an issue on the minds of our residents. And, you know, some of the things that we put out were Stop Chevron's Domination of Richmond, and when we were promoting community schools. So those are things you can do also. Now, once elected, how do we govern? Well, we govern with the community. We identify the problems in the city, which we've already been talking about through the campaign and through previous campaigns, gather more information from the community, get feedback, research issues, and help draft ordinances. So it's not only the candidate, the office holder, you know, when I was mayor, when I was council member, and the other council members of the RP, we sometimes draft our own ordinances and bring them to the community, but sometimes the community helps us with drafting something so we can bring it to the city council. We mobilize for issues. You know, if I bring in the minimum wage ordinance, hey, you know, we had to mobilize, make sure a lot of people were coming to the council to address that issue and support us. And we lobby other councilmen. So here's a basic electoral strategy. This was the 2014 campaign. That's a sign with me, Chobanka, and Eduardo. We have hundreds of volunteers who vote, and our candidates, you know, take no corporate money. I keep repeating this because it's so important. No corporations dominate our electoral field. And we start early and spend our money wisely. Here's an example of our campaign volunteers. Go door to door, talk about Richmond's perils and possibilities, always push back on Chevron. They're still in our community. And we mobilize at all sectors of our community to get out the vote. Here's an example of we have a newspaper that we have to fundraise for this, of course, called the Richmond Sun. And we put it out during elections, sometimes even in non-election years, just about the issues we're working on. And sometimes we drop them on people's porch. Other times, if we have the money, we mail them to households. And of course, we connect movements in election years and non-election years. Here's we put forward a Richmond IDs for all, including those with non-documented residents. And we think that helped press the state to eventually allow for driver's license, the state of California, to allow for driver's license for undocumented immigrants. Here is solar green jobs for all. These are things that we did way back. That was 2006, the green jobs thing we did. We voted no on a casino. I think 1,000 people came to that council meeting. Here is a mobilization that we did in Richmond. 3,000 people came, some from outside of Richmond, some actually from, you know, other places in California. It was the anniversary of that major Chevron fire, and we had 3,000 people walking from Richmond BART to which is our rapid transit, to the refinery. And Bill McKibbins was there. It was a great, really great example of people joining together to understand environmental justice and support Richmond. We build a coalition of support on progressive issues. There's some of the groups, of course, the RPA, ACE, APEN, Sierra Club, Communities for a Better Environment, 350.org, Somos Richmond is a Latino group. Unions, we always support unions, steelworkers, SEIU, CNA, ATU, I Don't Know More is our is of course the Native American group. I think I had showed this in another slide or a smaller version. This is we stood up to Wall Street during the foreclosure crisis that Richmond was hit big time. We had an innovative program called the Eminent Domain Program. The city was seeking to purchase mortgages from the big bank so we could keep our homeowners in their home and reduce the principals. Congress stopped that, sadly. Bernie came to Richmond in 2014, at the end of 2014. That was before he decided to run for president. He was thinking about it because he mentioned it. And of course, he gave his usual speech, which, you know, we all know about Wall Street and 95% of income has gone to the top. The money has gone to the top 1%. We don't give up, you know. Chevron spent over $3 million, as I had mentioned, in 2014, and all their candidates lost, all of ours won. Just three more slides. Local struggles, national attention. I was on the Bill Moyers show. We were in the New York Times, PBS, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, Richmond Nano show, and others. But progress is not a straight line. There are zigs and zags. The more we win, the more they try and stop us. And sometimes they succeed. So we lost some ground, sadly, in 2018 when a couple of our candidates lost. But we are gearing up for 2020. As we all know, no progress without struggle. Our goal is one city, one world. And we know future victories will require growth of our movement, reversal of Citizens United, removal of corporate money, uniting with all whose vision matches ours, the choice is ours. We're going to have danger to our environment, to people, to basically our well-being, or we could have health and equity and wonderful generations to come will be the beneficiary. So that's all I have to say. I do want to say I did write a book. I don't have any books with me, but you can pick up a card if you're interested about Richmond. All the money goes to this new organization, statewide organization, the California Progressive Alliance. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Gail. And I should have done a better job explaining the format of this session. So our next speaker is fellow Boston DSA member Matt Miller.
I think we're going to Robin next.
Yeah. Or we're going to switch it up and go with Robin next. Another DSA member from Chicago. And as I'm sure many of you have known, not to steal his thunder, but Chicago DSA was very successful in the recent city council election. So I can't wait to hear about the if you
can
hear me, take it away.
Yeah, I heard Gail that 2 years ago at a solidarity summer school. So I think it's interesting. Well, let me introduce myself. My name is Robin Peterson. I've been co-chair of Chicago PSA since June. I've been involved with the rent control campaign here for most of my time with DSA, and I'm also a member of Solidarity. During the city council elections, I worked for a candidate named Jeanette Taylor, who's in the 20th ward of Chicago, and she's one of the winning six socialists. So I was thinking about some of the differences with Chicago and Richmond. One is that we never expected to win six seats on city council of DSA members. The organizing that happened wasn't city-wide in the same way, although there are a few organizations that worked in all these elections in our city-wide, but I think they were very much like local board-based fights where the local communities realized that they needed to win seats and then take this power in the ward because the aldermen have so much power in Chicago around zoning, and there's a lot of fights against gentrification in all of these six wards. Also, to put it in context, why were we able to win 16? One reason that I think is super important is in 2012, the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike, and that was a time when this union was led by a rank and file movement and was fighting back against austerity. and Rahm Emanuel did that, and Daily before him had been selling off public assets, protecting public services for decades. And the teachers went on strike and pushed back against that. And that had ripple effects in a lot of different movements throughout the state. I went to the school at that time as a tutor, and the way the parents talked about this strike, they wanted to go walk out of the school after they saw the teachers do that, because our Rahm ended up closing our school to protest that. So everybody saw this, and they knew it was a victory. Like, the working class in Chicago saw this happen as a victory. But again, Rahm pushed back with the school closing, city school closing, the next spring. So kind of going off what Gail was saying about two steps forward, one step back. Another thing that led up to this was some people running in the 2015 election, 4 years ago, the last municipal elections. In some of these wards where we won, candidates ran and got really close, but lost. So that laid a lot of infrastructure and groundwork, both in terms of like a base for these candidates, but also organizations. For example, in the 33rd ward, where Rosana Rodriguez won in the last election, a CTO member, Tim Megan, ran, and after he lost, they formed an organization called 33rd Ward Working Families to keep fighting and eventually elect Rosana 4 years later. Another thing, Jeanette Taylor, the candidate I worked for, was part of a hunger strike that was led by community organizations. I would say it was a community organization was part of the leaders of this. And Jeanette had been an organizer with COCO. And this was because there was a high school on the south side, which is was serving mostly Black neighborhoods, and they was disinvested in. They kept threatening to close the school, and the parents couldn't ever get any response, so they decided to go on a strike to save the school in 2015. And that was something else. They ended up saving the school after 30 days without meeting. And this was something that I know people in Jeanette's ward had heard about, and they won all this reinvestment in that school. So these movements, the teachers, the community organizations, the parents fighting for schools, and the housing fight against gentrification, easily the groundwork for the victory we saw in this last election. And they also allowed these campaigns to be socialist and their messages to be really powerful. If those movements hadn't happened, then I don't think people would have ran on those things and talked about been able to name the enemies, like the developer, and demand things. Reinvestment in education and housing as they did in the last election. So another thing that was a reason for our victory was that the machine in Chicago was reliant on having money in the public sector and public sector patronage jobs. And as those have been cut and rolled back, the machine has weakened. And I think the machine means a lot of different things. There's not just one, but it's all dependent on that. And so in a lot of these boards, there were even more near losses for candidates who, these aldermen who've been in office for years. So you can really see that there's this wave of people being sick of the status quo and the machine not being able to protect themselves using the same things they've used for a long time. So for example, the Jeanette's board, this is the, on the south side, it's a mostly Black and Latinx, and the aldermen, three of the last four aldermen have been indicted on federal corruption charges. So, that's a pretty far out there extreme example, but that's the kind of stuff Congress needed for corruption too, like Richmond. And I think it's been interesting to see the way in the last election, like how people think about wrong with government and the system and like what is harming them, whether it's corruption or it's the developers. And fortunately, like most of our candidates were able to call it out as the developers wrong. And Lightfoot, on the other hand, like Brianna, more about corruption, although she's been forced to use the same language about fighting the big developers, too. So maybe I'll come back to that. I feel like I wasn't super clear about that. Kind of skipping ahead to where we're at now. The aldermen are uniting around some things that where there's already like ordinances around voting, but none of them are, well, I think we haven't been able to pass anything yet that hasn't already been like about to pass already. And I think our aldermen are struggling to learn the ropes in city council. And we're seeing how these offices aren't really made for movement leaders. They're made, they're intentionally confusing for them as well as for all of their constituents. The other thing that they're dealing with is they're thrown into having to provide services for their constituents. So this is something that aldermen in Chicago have to do is they have like all this power over their wards, but they're also responsible for providing like paving the streets and that kind of thing. And so people expect them to be good managers. And we're in our last election, and the one incumbent we had, Carlos Rosa, would had a track record would get asked about this constituents. And so it was a struggle in talking on the doors with people about trying to raise their expectations beyond this just being about can we get our roads made, can we get a new stop sign, can the dog poop get picked up. People always ask about this on the doors when you're talking about an alderman race, but we want to think about these races as a chance to ask for more than that and name the bigger forces that are causing these problems in our community. So I think it still kind of remains to be seen how because we didn't have the citywide alliance, like Richmond Progressive Alliance, we're working on how can we cohere our BSA members who are on city council to speak with one voice. And there, the new progressive aldermen, and it's more than just a group, about 10 of them, are speaking as a block about the city budget and trying to have more progressive revenue, invest in the things we need, and disinvest in things like the police. And that's work that's being done by United Working Families, which is a coalition that includes two of our big groups, and SEIU, HCII. So that, I think, is important work about pushing back against austerity. But I think that one of the challenges that we're seeing is we want the aldermen to continue to speak to the movement, and they're doing that, but I think there's still a kind of structural separation and isolation between these people who are now in office and the volunteers from the movements that got them elected. So I'll try to wrap this up, and I'll say, when thinking about working on elections, one thing someone said to me is they require an almost unimaginable amount of resources for in a city like Chicago. And I think that's true anywhere. They take a lot of time and money. So I think you want to be clear that this is an election where the specific power of that office is something you really need, and that you also have the opportunity to run on things like where you're naming the enemies and raising people's class consciousness, building the people power Dale was talking about. And that will resonate with people. And if otherwise, I think our focus as socialists should be on building movements. So we do this when this helps us build movements. And so we need candidates who can talk in these terms.
Not sure if you can hear me, Robin, but thank you so much for that. Definitely like the naming the enemies. I think people have seen now that link between what happens in Richmond, what happens in Chicago, and definitely what our next speaker is going to be talking about. I think as socialists, we're in a great position to do that. It's very hard for liberal Democrats to name the enemy while they're also taking money from the enemy. It puts them in a bind. So without further ado, our last speaker, Matt Miller, another Boston DSA member who has run some incredible city council and city races. So Matt, take it away.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I couldn't have, I actually didn't know what the other speakers precisely were going to speak about, but I couldn't have asked for a better segue, I think, into what I wanted to touch on, because I knew I only had 20 minutes to speak, and so I wanted to focus on sort of a narrower slice of why we should do electoral work as socialists, which is really about this outward-facing political education, class consciousness building in our communities, and using it to build movements. So a little bit of background about myself. I joined DSA in 2016 after when most of our new members joined. Basically the very first thing I got involved with was our electoral working group that got set up a few months into Boston DSA's like sort of resurgence. And I think I'm probably more than anyone in our chapter identified as like one of the like most pro-electoral people in our chapter, and I've heard people refer to me as electoralist, which I don't really love the term. But I've worked on, even before joining DSA, worked for, volunteered for a state rep who ultimately won, defeated an incumbent Democrat, Andrew Somerville, joined DSA after the fact. I managed the city council race for J.T. Scott in Somerville, who was a DSA member, identified as an anarchist, ran this tremendous grassroots campaign where we talked to the voters in Somerville about why developers were really one of the main causes of the gentrification and the problems we were facing as a city. And I worked on a few other campaigns. I managed the field operation for Nika Elugardo, who Boston DSA didn't actually endorse, but we probably put more support behind her campaign than any other group despite that. She defeated the Ways and Means chair of the Massachusetts State House. So despite all those really exciting victories, there's a lot about electoral work that I find to be a huge drag. it is a bummer when you work really, really hard, you throw yourself and you devote 12 months of your life to something, and then you come up short. You either lose by a little bit, which can be gut-wrenching in its own way, or you lose by a lot, can be also gut-wrenching. I've also seen the difficulties that you face sometimes, even when you win, and you end up in situations where you have less power as a movement than you thought you did. So I did a lot of organizing in Somerville with Boston DSA members, as well as Our Revolution Somerville, which was sort of a group we had founded really after Steve Early came out, one of the other Richmond Progressive Alliance activists, and talked about what RPA had been doing. We really tried to consciously model that movement mentality. We sort of, also similar to what I heard Robin say, won more races than we expected in 2017. There was J.T. Scott, Van Unkamp, and two people who identified as socialists, DSA members who ran and won their aldermen at that time, now city council races. But at the same time, we also endorsed a number of progressives, some people who ultimately, I think now we sort of may regret some of those endorsements because some of those people have become breaks on some of the progress that we might otherwise like to see. And I just want to highlight that because I think it's really important that we think, really critically as socialists about where we're getting involved and what are the trains that are really favorable us to build power, movement power. So what I find to be a really important part of our electoral work and how it helps build our movements is the opportunity it affords me to go talk to my neighbor, go down the hallway, knock on my neighbor's door and talk to her about the way development is causing our rents to go up. And I don't have that excuse on any random Tuesday to go knock on my neighbor's door. They think you're a little bit nuts if you knock on the door and just want to talk about politics with a stranger. But for better or for worse, we have this this capitalist representative democracy where everyone expects every 4 years you're going to have to vote for president. That's a really important vote that everyone wants to spend a lot of time thinking about. So that's an opportunity for us to have organizing conversations with people and bring them along. I certainly, 10 years ago, would not have identified as a socialist. It took getting excited and sort of mobilized by certain other political campaigns, primarily Bernie Sanders, but even people further to the right earlier. I am working for a guy in Cambridge named Jeevan Sabia Wheeler. He's a DSA member who's running for Cambridge City Council. And the opportunity we have there is to go knock on doors, talk to people about, we lead with that he doesn't take developer money, real estate developer money. And we lead with the fact that rents are out of control and he wants to establish rent control. We talk about how the MBTA, our public transit system, is falling apart due to underfunding. And his plan is actually have the city of Cambridge cover the cost to make it free for all residents right now, sort of embarrass the state into taking action. And these are pretty dramatic policies that definitely turn off, I think, maybe some of the more traditional Cambridge homeowners. But we're able to target renters and talk to people who are not as engaged. Evan has been canvassing a lot. Jeevan, we've got some DSA literature that helps people come to meetings after the fact. For me, it's really important to get people to have that starting point to talk about naming the enemy, naming the folks who are organized against us, because in my experience, it's the best way I've found to get people involved in Boston DSA, involved in socialism, is to help them to understand, to move them from the language of an election around developers, organized around their own interests, to get them to really understand first that developers, big corporations, sort of a governmental complex around our state house is really a class unto itself, and they have different interests than us. And then to lead those people to understand that all of us together, as renters, as working class people, have a different interest, and we can actually fight for those demands. And I don't want to just dwell on Cambridge, because I had, when I lived in Somerville, the Somerville Democrat city chair came up to me one day and just said, you know, you think it's so easy, you're in Somerville, not the rest of the state, the rest of this country is not like Somerville. What you guys socialists are talking about will resonate. Come out with me and canvas in the purple part of the state and I'll show you how hard it is. So I went out with her, and I had the best day of canvassing of my life, because I took the, there was a Democratic state Senate candidate who had this like terrible messaging. She ultimately lost her race in this purple district. She has terrible messaging. I sort of threw it all away, and I led with, she's the only candidate who's going to tax millionaires more. Your road I see is covered in potholes. Let's talk about that. She actually, on her literature, did identify that she wasn't taking any money from Big Pharma. And so I made that a whole big thing, because the opioid crisis is a real, actual crisis. And I got more, I was lucky because a lot of people answered their doors. But when she was sort of, when I met back up with the Democrats chair, and she's like, so how was it? It's like, I got 12 votes. And she was just sort of like, oh, okay. Well, that's not the usual. And I really have a firm belief that, you know, I didn't go and say, you know, I'm a socialist, you should be Marx, X, Y, Z. That's for like a year into it. I led with, you know, that something's wrong with the deck is stacked against you. Something's rigged here. You don't have good commuter rail service in Worcester. You don't have good transportation. Your schools are falling apart. There's parts of the state where there's schools that you can't get clean drinking water right now. And it's due to the austerity politics. To me, that's really important. That's the really important part of elections for me, is getting people to start to develop that class consciousness, and then hopefully turn that to maybe other electoral projects, maybe other types of organizing. I don't think it's the only path. I think my partner does a lot of great work with organizing tenants. I think there's a similar process where you knock on people's doors and talk about your apartment building's falling down, you have a scummy landlord, XYZ, but I definitely think this is an important tool for us to use. And when we see at the national level so much media attention focused on the presidential race, I think it's fantastic we have somebody out there saying they're socialist. And, you know, I won't say more. I don't won't even say his name, because I don't want people to accuse me of not talking about local politics. there's really three qualifications I want to put on that, because if I were to just say to you, so the real purpose for electoral politics, or why I get involved in campaigns, is to talk about socialism, you might get a sense of, okay, well then, we just need to find the person with the best politics and have them go run, it doesn't matter whether they win or lose. And I think that's wrong, because I think people don't stick around with something that doesn't feel like it's going anywhere or feels like it's a losing strategy. So there's a lot of really amazing candidates who have run for public office. In different places. One of the state reps who I mentioned earlier originally ran as no money Mike Conley, knocked on a bunch of doors, talked to voters, but never raised a cent. And he got his teeth kicked in that election. And I don't think that was necessarily a way that you would get people engaged and wanting to come back, something like that. So I think we have to put up candidates who know what they're doing, who have thought about it, where races where we think we can reasonably compete, because we want to be building a movement. We don't want to be making a statement and then having people say, okay, well, that was one thing I did, but you know, as Robin said, it's a lot of resources, a lot of energy. Every day after every election, I usually cry in the shower because it's so draining. The second real important caveat that I wanted to lay out this is we really do need movement candidates, and I totally so endorse everything that Robin and Gail said about the need to find people who are think of themselves as part of a movement. There's a huge difference in the way that I've seen the candidates we have supported in the local over the years interact with us, depending on whether or not they joined before or after they ran, depending on whether or not they knew that we had supplied a huge amount of the volunteer labor, or whether we just gave them, say, a paper endorsement. You get people like J.T. Scott in Somerville now who know that we as ESA and our Revolution Somerville, which is essentially half ESA folks, or otherwise socialists, that they knocked 2/3 of his volunteer doors and helped him get his message out, and probably now know 50 people in his neighborhood who, if he does something wrong, they could complain to, or more positively, could help support him when he takes courageous stands. So one of the first things he did in office was they relegated him to a committee that is like the bottom of the barrel. It's the appointments and confirmations here, committee, where it's historically been a rubber stamp. The mayor support, the mayor proposes a candidate for a board or a commission, or it's about police officer promotions. And JT had looked back and like over the last 20, 30 years, there's no history of the board ever rejecting a candidate. And one of the first things he did was reject a police officer for promotion, and really enrage everyone there. And there were reasons in the HR file that made JT think this is not someone that we need to be empowering, and I want to have a conversation. And oh, by the way, our process for how I get this information is totally broken. So he took, this is a pretty terrible political calculation to take in almost any city across the country, pick a fight with the police chief about the process issue that probably even most ESA members are gonna have their eyes glaze over a little bit about. But we were able to get the word out and help support him on that. And I think that's what we want, a really movement-based and movement-oriented candidate. Once they get in office, is gonna feel that support and be empowered to do things. I think we want to be supporting those folks as much as we can. And the third real caveat that I wanted to throw out there is that the material conditions of where we are really matter on this. So California has a very different election law than Massachusetts, for example. So in California, there's a jungle primary system for most statewide races. So in Massachusetts, if you run as a Democrat, you're going to be in the Democratic primary with a fourth of the size electorate. That costs four times less to run for office. You have to knock on four times less doors. You can get into office, defeat an incumbent Democrat, get into power that way a little more easily. When I'm advising candidates and socialists, like, should I run as a Democrat? Should I run third party? Because the Democratic Party is terrible. It's corporate backed, it's corporate owned. I still advise them to run as a Democrat because just for that tactical reason. Whereas in California, it strikes me, and I'm not the expert, and so Gail may tell you all afterwards that I'm completely full of bunk, but it would strike me that you don't have that same disincentive, and so you ought to be able to run as a green, as a socialist, as an independent, and not have that same penalty because you have to still run in that general election, get the same number of votes that you would otherwise. In California, I looked this up before I gave the talk, the lower house of your state legislature, each district contains 465,000 people. And you have to run essentially in general election conditions. That I was amazed at the work everyone put into Jovanka Beckles. I think she's an amazing, like, once in a lifetime candidate from what I've seen. Well, twice in a lifetime because you also broke. and that was a tremendous race that I love following. In Massachusetts, our lower house has 43,000 residents per district, and it's a Democratic primary with lower turnout. 1,000 to 5,000 people will decide these elections. So that's, I think, a fraction of what the Chicago alderman races are as well. So there's opportunities for us in Boston, I think, to be a little more opportunistic about certain races, Boston, other parts of the state, to be a little more opportunistic there about getting someone in who we think can help us organize around an issue in a community, elevate that issue, and then act as like sort of a tribune in state office that may not exist in other states. And so that's something where I'm like a nerd. I love reading about all the election law stuff. You wanna really dig deep into what works and what doesn't in different localities, because some city councils and town committees here, town meetings in Massachusetts, sometimes the seats aren't even full. Sometimes you can get elected very easily. There may be other opportunities there. And then I know I've got just a couple minutes left, and so I wanted to highlight another aspect of the conditions that might be different, which is the amazing wins that Gail talked about in Richmond around raising the minimum wage in Richmond, about that foreclosure law, and also about, you know, things like rent control. These are all things that are illegal for cities to do in Massachusetts. You can't change the minimum wage law in Massachusetts. You can change the living wage for city employees and things like that. But there are a lot less, on certain spectrums, there's a lot less concrete wins you can have. And so that's actually sort of reluctantly pulled me back up towards the state level. This past year, I started a group called Act on Mass, which focuses on state house transparency in Massachusetts, because every bill that our city councilors in Somerville have tried to pass around raising a very small transfer fee on real estate speculation, that died in our legislature. We don't have a vote on, we don't have a recorded vote on who voted it up or down. The same thing with broader issues statewide around protecting immigrants, making us a sanctuary state, raising capital gains taxes. There's just issue after issue where we don't have the tools to even organize around. Whereas in California, I looked it up, all the committee votes are public. So you can know if Buffy Wicks votes the wrong way, you can say that's terrible. Assemblywoman Wicks, we're going to organize around this. I can't do that here in Massachusetts. So that's why I've been pulled in this direction of almost like more liberal transparency issues, because I think that will help us in Massachusetts push this stuff through. So the TLDR of my talk is, this is really, elections can be extremely frustrating. They take a lot of resources, but it still, to me, makes a lot of sense to put a lot of our time into this, because it will help us raise class consciousness, bring people into DSA and other socialist groups to help build a movement. And we just have to be mindful that we're being smart about it. So we're now going to go to the Q&A section. Out of curiosity, does this podium move? I was going to say, actually, if you both want to come to the front, so that way people could hear you.
Sure.
And Robin, if you can hear us, we're putting you back up there.
Oh, awesome.
For this.
So very quickly, in case you've never been to a Lefty or DSA meeting before, we use something called progressive staff. What that means is that we try to highlight marginalized voices who are suppressed in our community. And also, we might bump people if you're talking too much. I might put you to the back of the queue and try to raise those voices who don't get to be heard too often. And if for some reason we're going a little bit long-winded with your question, if I give you a very polite spin, that's just my way of saying, get to the question so we can try to get as many as possible. Looking at how much time we have allotted, we have about what we planned for, so 30 minutes. We'll see how far we go. But to kick it off, does anyone have an opening question for any of our panelists here today? Yes, please. And if you wouldn't mind, just quickly your name, preferred pronouns as you ask your question.
Denise, she, her. I have a question for Gail. You mentioned what happened in 2018, and I would be interested to hear more about what actually happened, why there was that setback.
Sure. So in 2018, we had two candidates running, two RPA candidates running. One of them won. So we lost. Jovanka Beckles ran for assembly, and she didn't run for city council, so her seat was vacant, and somebody else got it. The other person was the person who took my seat when I resigned in July 2017 to run for lieutenant governor. We had the super majority right on the Richmond City Council, 5 out of 7. I knew if I resigned, we'd still have 4 RPA members to elect or to appoint. Even another RPA member, which they did, but this person was not very well known. Some of us had wanted someone else to do the appointment, but it didn't go that way. So the person who got appointed ran for the first time and did not get elected. There were some concerns in the community about some votes that had taken place that weren't quite in line with the community at large. And some of the RPA members were upset and didn't work on the campaigns as much as they had in the past. So we lost 2 seats. So we only have 3 out of 7 now when we had 5 out of 7. So I think that's why, but we all know that, setbacks occur, and that's, you organize and you learn from them, you reevaluate.
Other questions?
Let's go one and then two.
Sandeep He from Pioneer Valley DSA. Question for Robin. So you mentioned that you thought one of the reasons that you were able to get so many people into the council was the decline of public sector jobs and the patronage that goes along with that. And I'm wondering if you think, is that a general sort of, you know, because we reflexively support public sector unions and public sector jobs generally, but is it true that, or is it fair to say that in big cities, those jobs might actually be like a, you know, might be blocking certain kinds of reform?
Yeah. I wouldn't put it that way. This is why I think it's important when we use our messaging that we distinguish, we don't, our enemy is not the machine and it's not corruption. It's the developers, the bankers, the capitalist class. It's the people who donate to Rahm Emanuel. And I think that I kind of like using the machine because it refers to something, but I think we have to be really clear and talk about it. So I think the earlier version was very reliant on patronage jobs, but since the 90s, at least, there's a new version then, which also has to do with contracts. It has to do with the network of the people who donate to Rahm Emanuel. People might donate to him, get a city contract, get a lot of work for their law firm, get something rezoned, and that is tied into this network that keeps these people in power. I think when we think about the job, I definitely wouldn't say that they're having, I think as socialists we want to pay for more of those jobs. But I also think that in the past, making sure that every ward, whether white, black, or Latinx, got some of those jobs was perhaps a way to shore up the machine against a socialist attack, you know, like saying, well, like changing the system rather than just giving a few people, like a certain segment of the population, jobs that sustain them and let them lead a middle class life. So that's the sort of nuanced take I have on that.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Robin. Sir.
Matthew Heaton. This is also directed at Robin. When the race was running to replace Emanuel, I think Lightfoot at the beginning was seen as one of the possible progressive solutions to this problem. And the impression I get now is that that isn't necessarily so. And I'm wondering what she has become. And in addition, how substantial is the left on the city council to influence the mayor's role?
I'm glad you asked that because I felt like I didn't talk about Lightfoot enough. I think that these last elections were a referendum on Rahm Emanuel's policies of austerity, and also he was pushed out by these Black youth-led movements because he covered up the murder of a Black teenager named Laquan McDonald. And Lightfoot was elected on this energy that was anti-Rahm energy, but she has basically I expect her to, in the just slightly better version of the same policies. I mean, she's already pushing an austerity agenda in this, the city budget that's going to be passed this fall. So, I think that our fight is going to be against Lightfoot. And it's going to be a hard fight because the mayor has a lot of ways of keeping the city council in line and punishing people, taking things away from them if they, and making their jobs a lot harder if they go against her. But I think that's why we have a lot of potential of having 6 ESAs under aldermen and about 10 new progressive aldermen on city council. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I guess that's right.
Other questions? We're going to go 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on the comment that Robin made about the challenges of people once they're in office. And particularly, I heard Rosanna Rodriguez at the Solidarity Summer School in Chicago. Is that her name, Rosanna?
Yes.
Right. And one of the things she talked about is that typically the aldermen get constituents coming in to solve their problems, like, you know, my landlord is giving me trouble, whatever. The streets, the trash, and that she was trying to imagine her office as an organizing center. She had hired some people to actually be organizers and community outreach people because she didn't want to just be immured inside the workings of city council and continue this idea of movement building. So I'd like to ask Gail and Matt, who have also had this experience, how have your candidates tried to, once in office, you know, think about the role of the office itself? And Gail, you talked about some of that, like drawing on people in the community to help develop ordinances. We're doing some of that in Portland too. It's kind of an inside-outside strategy, but how do you actually get to use the office in a different way? Because it has certain kinds of resources. And can you, and what are the barriers to that?
Okay, so when I first became a council member, the first thing I did was create a packet reading group so that every time, you know, the meeting would come up, I'd have a few people in my living room helping me read the packet and coming up with questions to ask. And, you know, some were quite easy. We knew we opposed, we supported, but others were a little more nuanced. And so that was one approach. And that communication always has to happen. You know, with the RPA, as it grew over time, we became a membership organization with membership meetings, with votes on certain issues, developing. We always had a platform. We developed a more extensive one and some bylaws to make it clear that we will only endorse and hold onto endorsements of candidates who support the positions of the membership. So, you know, we didn't have 100% clarity at first, but we have more clarity now, and that's how we want to make it clear and that the elected official isn't there just to separate themselves, which happens at almost all the time, from those who elected them and from the community at large. So we worked very hard at getting that help. We have people researching things. We have action teams within the RPA, like a housing action team, various other action teams, immigration action team, and they help draw up policy and then put it in the hands of a council member, an RPA council member, to bring to the council. When I was mayor, I, of course, had someone talked about appointments and such to commissions and boards, and I would always make sure I would bring forward RPA members, or if we didn't have an RPA member who wanted to be on that particular commission, someone else in the community that would share the views of us in that particular commission. So it was really building a structure beyond the council member or the mayor to have this work done, whether it was the research or the development of ordinances and the development of mobilizing so that the council member isn't alone. And so the council member doesn't have to rely only on themselves, and so that the community feels that the council member is accountable to them. So I don't know if that gives you some sense of how we did it, and we're still working on doing it.
I love the packet reading.
There's
a little note to myself.
Imagine
giving it to me like that.
Yeah, I don't know that we've figured out a good solution to this in the Boston area. Part of it is just the Yankee frugality, I guess, that's baked into some of our offices. The Somerville City Council has no ability to hire staff at all. So JT and Ben are on their own. We've tried in Somerville to have people who are with DSA, with our Evolution Somerville, to like try to do something like a packet reading group that hasn't really necessarily caught on. There's even at the state level, anyone who we get elected into state legislature, they get essentially one staffer until they're promoted to be like a committee chair or vice chair. And so only the people who immediately compromise their politics will get that. So the people who stay like sort of thorns in the leadership of corporate Democrats side get one person who is drowning in constituent services and just like inside the building stuff. Now, State Rep Mike Connolly has spent a lot of time in Cambridge this past year organizing against a redevelopment, essentially the sale of public lands into private hands for this Sullivan Courthouse redevelopment. He launched a bunch of canvassing. He got the community really involved. That vote just went the wrong way, but that was a good first step. Cambridge City Council does get to hire a full-time staffer with actual like enough pay to live on. And so Jeevan and Ben Simon is the other endorsed candidate in Cambridge. They're both running on rent control, both running as socialists. They both, I think, want to, once the election is over, turn towards helping to create like a renters union or organizing tenants in some way, because in Cambridge right now, essentially there's not, that doesn't exist really, except if you're gonna say it's maybe the Yimby group, which I don't want to accept.
Question from the gentleman in the back.
Thanks. Thanks for your presentation. I just have two quick questions. One is, a big part of the left wing elections is mobilizing non-engaged voters who are disillusioned with parties. And I'm wondering what your experiences are with trying to increase engagement of, non-aligned, non-mobilized voters in between election cycles, because the closer you get to the election, obviously the more necessary about the window. So what have you, in your experiences, have been trying to work on engaging those folks? And number two, this is a sort of broader question. I know this is about local politics, and it's really impressive what everybody's been doing in the last few years and all these campaigns, but I'm just curious, like in broad strokes, how do you think about how the work you're doing in these local struggles fits into the broader project of, building genuine left movements, around the country, the extent that, that's something you can think about in your, very limited free time that you don't have, you're working on all these campaigns. But, once you're getting up to the state level, as you've already talked about, the difficulties of substituting, ground game for money become so much harder. So how do you think about that, to the extent that you have time to use them?
Thanks. Does anyone up on the panel want to start first before I point and designate?
I could start, but you could point. Okay. So how to engage non-voters, even during non-election years. We definitely did that. I mean, after you run on a platform, with your key issues as a candidate, you have to follow through on that. We ran to oppose the casino. So we kept the mobilizing going so that when there was a ballot measure. Do we want the community? Do we want a casino or not? Community said no. And we had proposed no as activists in the RPA. And so when the council voted on it, we made sure we had all those people coming to the council meeting and speak up. We, after the Chevron major fire, We didn't want people to forget. You know, people sadly, even in a major fire like that, can forget about things. Oh, Chevron says we got everything under control. It was an error, even though they were criminally prosecuted and convicted on it. What we did was, what I did, I was mayor and I started a I Love Richmond campaign, went door to door. This is in a non-election year. And said, we passed out these window signs on one side. We had a beautiful daisy, said, I love Richmond. On the other side, it had a picture of the fire. And it's, and we said, put either side in your window. These are window signs. Some people put the plume, some people put the daisy. And we said, we'll never forget, you know, Chevron is polluting our community, causing risk. So we knocked on doors and we said, hey, listen, you know, we have to keep the pressure up and hold this big refinery accountable. And so, and then of course that segued into later the next campaign that, you know, we talked about it as well. So you can do, and we hold forums in between campaigns. How do you engage non-voters? Sometimes we knock on every single door, like for the I Love Richmond campaign, we didn't just knock on doors that were voters. And sometimes during our candidate campaigns, we go door to door, not just voters as well. And we bring those registration forms with us. And, you know, we hold forums about how important voting is to play a role in your community. So those are just a few ideas. Yeah.
That was great. Robin, would you also like to weigh in about how to engage typical non-voters? And maybe if Chicago DSA has any plans about how to like organize those people as well for upcoming elections or campaigns?
I don't know if I have a clear answer to that. From my experience on Jeanette Taylor's campaign, this very marginalized neighborhood, Woodlawn, the park of Chicago, back of the yards. There were a lot of places we couldn't reach people because their buses were broken. That's how run down these apartment buildings were. Sometimes I would call people up and they'd be like, well, I'm just trying to make rent right now. I can't really think about this. So, I think I haven't figured out how to overcome that kind of thing. I think we have to be creative, and sometimes that might be about engaging people to vote. We think of voting as an easy ask. It's easier than getting them to come out to something, but maybe it's not the first step for some people. So I think we have to, that requires a lot of thought, but I don't have the answers.
I pivoted that to you because this is something that we also struggle with in Boston DSA. So I was hoping Chicago had some answers for me. But we had another question somewhere over here.
I forgot to do the other part of that question. Just very quickly, how do you tie it to the larger movement? You know, one thing that we do in Richmond is bring resolutions, like, for example, anti-war resolutions, to have the city take a position. And did anti-war resolution against war in Iran back in Bush administration, which now is another coming up forward again. And I did things like join Mayors for Peace, which was an international organization. Now as the California Progressive Alliance, we're bringing these local issues, tying them together, and, you know, bringing forward not only statewide issues, but federal issues, because we have, you know, California congressional candidates. So now working on a state organizing level, we're able to highlight some of these, you know, larger issues. But it continues to be, there's nothing wrong with somebody working on a local level and tying it to the larger movement. In fact, no city is an island. So we should be doing that.
Thank you. You, sir, and then you probably maybe have time for one or two more. So you'll be next.
All right. So once the movement candidate is victorious, successful, what mechanisms or ideas have helped movements or your movements hold your elected officials accountable?
Sorry. So one thing Boston DSA has tried to do is, and our revolution, Somerville, did the same, was we essentially got our own voter file, and I know Richmond does this as well, but it's sort of run and sort of own that voter outreach as an organization as much as you can. Sometimes the candidates do their own work in addition and usually have to win, but by having a large base of people who we know, like, okay, you know, it's sort of like a nuclear option, but if you needed to, they know that you know who voted for them or who they think voted for them. And so if they really just start to backtrack, they know that you can more effectively go back and talk to their voters. In terms of maybe a more positive way, I mean, I think honestly it's about getting people to turn up and find projects that are not, so I guess I struggle with most of the next steps where we like try to keep people engaged, the movement engaged. It always tends to fall back on like coming before the city council or the state legislature or like doing more political stuff. And so I would love to see a way for us to try and like in our neck of the woods where housing is such an important issue to try and merge those together so that we're building like an independent tenants union that can, if they want it, that becomes a power block then. But I don't have a good answer, I don't think.
I would just say that really the power that we have to hold elected officials accountable is to vote them out if they aren't. And the RPA struggled with this because I mentioned a couple of votes were not in line with the membership by a couple of our candidates. And so we tightened up our bylaws and we said endorsement will not you will not be endorsed, or the steering committee will determine, you know, that they have the power to determine whether an endorsement is withdrawn because of a lack of accountability. So I think you have to put it in your bylaws, and you have to make it clear that we, you know, voters have the power to, and organizations have the power to withdraw endorsements. It's a hard one.
I was just wondering, in my history, I've been an active member of SANU of 509 here, and I was on the joint board. We would routinely be asked for endorsements of all sorts of horrible Democrats. So just wondering what your, this won't be so much for California, but in Massachusetts, specifically Somerville, what kind of relationship have you built with unions, endorsements, and that sort of thing? It seems like it would be a natural for whatever union.
Yeah, so in Somerville, it seems to be different city to city and region to region, but in Somerville, there's, from day one, we had a lot of labor folks involved, some folks who are with SEIU 888 in particular, who were really involved in some of the organizing to begin with. And so we had some connections there. Some of our challenger candidates actually got endorsed by SEIU 888, which was a surprise because normally, the process was, we expected was like, okay, the union is going to endorse the incumbent. Maybe we can get them to stay out of it. So now there's been a lot of work that folks in Somerville, my comrades there, have been putting into building this other coalition called Somerville Stands Together, which is about tackling the housing crisis while also making sure that we're having good union jobs. And so there's the building trades involved with that, which is a pretty amazing combination. We have not done as well with maybe service sector workers. We've done like strike support for Stop and Shop, and I think we'll continue to try to do that. The one sort of thing I just want to flag is I'm seeing something that's actually really troubling, which is some like lefty, I have not seen socialists do this, but some lefty progressive city council candidates will take a stand that says, I'm not taking any developer money and I'm not taking any building trades money either, because they usually want the projects to go forward. And I think that's really bad. It splits, it plays into right-wing talking points. There's a candidate in my neck of the woods now who's getting tarred as being anti-union for saying that when she's not. I think it's just really, I think we gotta be really careful that we don't ever say something negative about building trades, even if, like as in the case of Somerville, they repeatedly would sort of get part of their deal and then fall away or argue against us, and we just have to deal with it as a, in a loving way and try to uplift each other. I don't know if that answered your question.
So, I'm having a little trouble hearing the questions, but I did want to answer the one about movements and accountability.
Sure, and that'll actually be a great closing. Unfortunately, we are out of time for more questions, but Robin, finish us off.
Okay. We're finding that it's hard to hold our six DSA member aldermen accountable because, well, there are a few reasons that the aldermen don't want to be committed accountable to us. One, we're still an overwhelmingly white organization. Two, not ward-based, we're citywide, which is different, and we're a socialist organization. And the way I've been trying to think about it as co-chair is, well, we didn't get these candidates elected on our own. So the movement has been elected, and like the members of these organizations that led these movements came out to volunteer for them. So how could we build a coalition that unites these organizations but doesn't do it the way all the other coalitions for the most part work in Chicago, where which is their staff get together in a room around a table, maybe with one member from the organization, and they make the decisions, and you never really know if the decision. So could we have the members come together in that be the body that these aldermen are accountable to? So that's what I'm trying to think about, the accountability, like a convening, a congress of members of these actual Chicago.
Okay. I think that's a great closing point. We can give a round of applause to